Today is August 26th. I'm Leslie McCartney, and I want to thank Gail and Walt Phillips for inviting us into their home today to speak with us. We also have with us here Sherry Modro, and we also have with us Jeannie Phillips. So again, thank you very much for letting us come and talk to you. If we could just start off, let's start with Gail. Can you just briefly talk about where you were born and where you grew up and your parents and what they did? Mm-hmm. That would be great.
My grandparents came from Sweden as missionaries right after the gold rush. My mom was born up in Northwest Alaska, and she met my dad in Nome during the Second World War. And he was a young soldier from Arkansas. And when he was in the first grade in Hope, Arkansas, the teacher asked him, "What's the capital of Alaska?" And he said, "Nome." And she said, "That's right." So from that point in time, he was going to go to Nome, Alaska. When he turned 15, he was a great big guy. He got accepted into the Army. And they, in those years, you could put, where did you prefer to go? Where your tour of duty? He said, "Alaska, Alaska, Alaska." They immediately sent him up. It was a young boy when he got up to Nome. Anyway, he met my mom there. And a couple of years later, he got transferred to Juneau. My mom was working for the Weather Bureau. She also got transferred to Juneau, which was very fortuitous. I was born in Juneau. Mm-hmm. And then we went right back to Nome. And I was raised in Nome and graduated from high school in 1962. Mm-hmm. Went to the university in Fairbanks. Graduated there in 67. And then went back to Nome to teach for a couple of years before we moved to Anchorage.
So you said your grandparents were Swedish missionaries?
Swedish.
Swedish Covenant?
Swedish Covenant Church, Evangelical Swedish Covenant Church.
And yes. Where were they posted?
They were in Minnesota, mm-hmm. and Wisconsin, Minnesota, and they got transferred to the Seward Peninsula. So their mission field was Golovin, White Mountain, Elam. My grandfather named the town of Elam, and eventually then, when my grandmother got very sick and passed away, my grandfather then transferred down onto the Yukon, mm-hmm. and was the magistrate at Marshall for many, many years. Mm-hmm. My folks lived in Nome the whole time.
Right, wow. And Walt, can you tell us a little bit about your early days?
Well, I guess in some ways my family was parallel Gales. My grandparents on my father's side came to Valdez in 1907. Worked at grandmother was a school teacher, and between the two of them, they weren't missionaries, but they were lay people active in the church. And my mother came to the Copper Center area in 1937 and she was a medical missionary. Mm. And in fact, the work that she started there is what became the hospital in Glen Allen that's now a clinic. They met on the trail between Valdez and Copper Center, and were married in 1939 Christmas Eve, and I came along in January of 41, but we didn't stay for long in Valdez. Situation with the war changed a lot of people's lives, and we ended up actually outside for a few years, mm-hmm. and then came back to Palmer in 1947. So that's where most of my formative years were, was in Palmer. My dad was he came to help with the construction of a children's home, and ended up staying on as director well into the 80s. And so I grew up at home in Palmer, mm-hmm. graduated in 58, spent a couple of years touring outside, just doing odd jobs, and went to a year of school in Seattle, and came back to the University of Alaska in fall of 1960, and hung out there for the next 7 years.
So, Gail, what did you study then at UAF?
Business.
Mm-hmm.
And Walt studied geology. He is a geologist.
Right, yeah. So what, any outstanding memories that you have of the time that you were attending UAF?
Oh, I have lots of outstanding memories.
Do tell.
When I moved there, we had a girls' dorm, Wickersham Hall, and we had curfews at Wickersham, and it was quite a structured university compared to what it is today. But we had an awful lot of good times there at the university. We did one thing one time that I don't know if they've ever done it again, but the Utilidors ran under Wickersham, and the boys would always try to get into Wickersham home. We had a house mother that was a real old battle axe, and she was bound and determined none of those boys were going to get in. So when she left the university, then we had a house mother that was a little bit more lenient, and one night all of us girls planned, and the girls were in MAC also. Oh no, not MAC, just us girls. We planned a raid on the boys' dorm on MAC. And we had it very well organized. We had six teams, one on each floor at each end of the building, and we had whistles. And we left Wickersham, and we got to MAC, and we blew those whistles, and we were in and out of that dorm within about 3 or 4 minutes, and back in Wickersham before it dawned on everybody what had happened. And we were always quite proud of that. But we certainly had good times during our time there. And Walt was there at the time when the engineering and mining and geology students blew out all the windows on campus.
Oh, tell us about that, Walt. Yeah.
We paid dearly for that. If not in reputation, I think it cost us, in the end, it cost us each $20 out of pocket, but a whole bunch of labor that spring putting in
new windows.
So
it was a tradition on Engineers' Day that we'd wake up the campus with a little wake-up call to explosives. And traditionally, it was done down at the bottom of the hill below beyond the railroad embankment, so that the embankment absorbed most of the concussion and forced the sound up. And on this particular year, the two gentlemen that were placing the explosives got a little lazy and figured if they buried them in snow, it wouldn't have to go so far. Well,
they were a little inebriated also.
Well, the biggest concern of mine was they buried it right adjacent to the university greenhouse, so they totally destroyed that year's crop. They didn't take out a bunch of windows on campus. My a fonder memory I have of an engineering day prank the year before, I think it was in the fire hall, and we managed to get a hold of some green dye, and I don't even remember the chemical composition. We did check it out, read the MSDS to make sure that it wasn't toxic, mixed a truck full of it, and went out the middle of the night and sprayed all the campus green, all the snowbanks green, which was pretty exciting, we thought, till the next morning when we woke up. And what we didn't know is when the stuff froze, it turned orange. So the entire campus was orange instead of green. That was a bit of a backfire.
Funny.
And the green was, in of course, in honor of St. Patrick's.
Right.
One fun thing that we did, when we were there, it was in the days of Vietnam, and so there were campus protests all over the place. Well, we in Alaska weren't necessarily big into doing those kind of protests, but Lathrop Hall had just been built, and the wash machines weren't, and it was a boys' dorm then, and the wash machines weren't operable. And so the boys, they were trying to borrow laundry facilities in the other dorms and everything. Well, it was Governor's Day on campus, and Woods Hole had just been completed, and they had just built that beautiful big fountain, and the flags were all up because Governor Egan was coming on campus. So we arranged a very gentle protest. We filled Woods Hole with laundry detergent, and we strung clothesline among all the flagpoles, And we were all there washing clothes and hanging them up on the flagpoles when the governor came up. Needless to say, President Wood was not very happy with us.
But it did get locked.
But we did get the wash machines fixed. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So can you talk a little, Gail, about, I take it you were both first in your family to go to university then?
Yeah, and I was the first in a huge family. And my dad's side and my mother's side and grandparents and everything to go to college.
Oh. Yeah. And you said earlier you had six siblings?
I have six younger sisters.
So you were the oldest. Yeah.
Yes. And one, two, three, four of them also went to the university.
So your parents really encouraged you for education?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. There was, you know, there was no money for college at all when we were growing up. I mean, it was unheard of that you would have the opportunity to put money aside for college. That just wasn't happening. And so both Walt and I, you know, we worked our way through college. One time I had three jobs on campus, and that was the norm for most kids on campus.
And what made you study business?
Well, I had all my life I wanted to be a nurse. And when I was a freshman and started taking the courses and talking to the professors and such, I realized that if there was a little child that was beaten or a senior adult beaten and brought into a hospital, I'd have to take them home to take care of them. And unless I married the richest person in the world, I was not going to be able to do that. So I had to make a real mental adjustment in my mind, and business was right up my alley, and I was good at business, so that was fine. I can remember one incident. Melba Pelosi was the head of our department at that time, and we weren't a very big department, for sure, but she told us this outlandish tale that sometime in our professional business lives, we would be able to get on the phone and see the person talking on the other end of the phone, and we just snorted and laughed at her. That was never going to happen. And so if you think about having the electric typewriter, which became such an innovation when it happened, and that was in the late 50s, early 60s, and to what we have the technology we have available today, it's unbelievable in that short period of time.
And you, Walt, you're the first one in your family to go to university, too?
Well, not really. My mother was a registered nurse, she had completed coursework in Pennsylvania. And my dad had taken some post-high school studies, but had not received a degree. But both my sister and I were encouraged strongly to go on to school. But we did have to work our way through, which was fine. Gail touched on marrying the richest guy around. Well, she didn't do that, but she did marry a guy that had money at the right time. At one point, we got, and I don't remember what year it was, but we got back to school, and a grant that she had been banking on didn't come through, and she was a couple hundred dollars short, and I had had a good summer. And so I loaned her the money. Now, I haven't got it back yet, but it made me keep better track of her for a while.
We'll be celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary next summer.
Oh, congratulations.
So I might give him the money back at that time as a little gift. And if you compound interest since 1964, could be quite a check.
Where did you get married?
In Nome. My grandfather married us. My next youngest sister and us, we had a double wedding, and this was, you know, it was a pretty big event for Nome. And when my grandfather, at the end of the ceremony, turned around to introduce us to the congregation, Walt and I being the oldest, he introduced us first as Mr. and Mrs. Walter Linskoog, which Linskoog was the name of my sister's husband. And he did it with a twinkle in his eye, and he did it on purpose. I know he did.
Very funny. Yeah. Well, you went into engineering, you said. That's what you studied at UAM?
Geology.
Geology. Yeah. And always had an interest in geology?
Well, actually, it came a little later in my college. Going in, I thought I might want to be an engineer of some sort, but found that I wasn't really keen on too much arithmetic and mathematics. And then I was toying with the idea of architecture. And so I had, meanwhile, I had to take a science class of some sort. So I tried first the historical geology, then general geology, and I found that I really enjoyed it and had a knack for it. And so I got sidetracked into geology and haven't left.
Any memorable teachers or professors that you remember being there that maybe had an influence on your life?
Well, probably Troy Payway was the head of the department at the time. He had he was a very enthusiastic geologist, particularly interested in Pleistocene geology or recent geology and glacial activity. And then later in my career, Dr. Forbes was kind of my mentor during graduate school. So there were lots of others.
So you did your undergrads and then your masters and
yes.
PhD?
Just two. Yeah.
Stuff.
That was enough.
That's enough. Definitely. And how about you, Gail? Any fond memories of any influential teachers?
Well, I did have some very good teachers. Melba Pelosi was very strict, but she was a good teacher. But I had one English teacher one time that really caused me a lot of consternation. I minored in children's literature because I thought I could always, I could always go back and teach reading. And I tutored reading the entire time I was going to college. I tutored reading in the grade schools in Fairbanks. And I thought, okay, that would be an alternative, something that I could do. Well, this one teacher I had, and I was a senior, so, I had finished all my requirements. I was taking this elective course, and his favorite author was Norman Mailer, and I wrote my senior dissertation on what I didn't like about Norman Mailer. He gave me a D- in the course. No. And I went to the dean, and I said, just because we have a difference of opinion doesn't mean, my essay was structurally correct. I had my own thought process. He just didn't like how I approached it. So I challenged that grade, and I did get it changed, which was fine. We had some very interesting, there was good, I think the entire time I was there, we had more good teachers than not.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember Lola Tilley at all?
No, I didn't. I never had a class from her. I mean, I remember her, definitely.
Yeah.
But I never had a class directly from her. I think she was in home ec at that time. And at the oldest of seven kids growing up, and always other people living with us when I was growing up, I had plenty of home ec. I had plenty. I didn't need to take any home ec classes.
Do you remember Dr. Wood at all?
Oh, yes. And, I really liked him. I liked both he and his wife. They were, I think they actually moved the university at the time we got there. They moved it into a whole different generation and a whole different venue for the state of Alaska. They brought it out of kind of a small campus into something that was going to be part of Alaska's development. And I give them a lot of credit for that. We had a lot of run-ins with him because he was always trying these different things. And I was on student government then, that time, so, the students are never satisfied with what the administration was doing.
So what were some of the issues of the day then in the student government?
Most of those were just easy issues, like the food in the cafeteria, the lounge hours. We did have one thing that caused quite a bit of consternation for us. The student government was always trying to raise money for student activities. And this one year, we couldn't get the Kingston Trio to come to Alaska, but we got the Chad Mitchell Trio to come, and we were so excited. We're going to have this huge concert and
our fundraiser,
and our main targeted audience would be the military base. And the night they were scheduled to perform was the night President Kennedy declared the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Uh-huh.
My uncle was the commander at Fort Wainwright at the time. His name was Lincoln Ost, and they shut down the base. And I called him and I said, Uncle Lincoln, you can't do this. And he said, Gail, we can. But, that our student government took a huge hit. It took us a long time to make up that debt. And we, the students, paid that debt back. So, yeah, like kind of like blowing out the windows. They held the students responsible in those days.
Were you involved then? It was time of Vietnam War. Was there a lot of political activism on?
Not that much. We did have a lot of our classmates, and a lot of the kids I grew up with in Nome all went into the war. Mm. But we didn't have, I don't remember a lot
there
of demonstrations
very,
or
very
protests.
Little, very little protests.
Yeah.
Well, at that time, we still got our news pretty late.
Yes.
Any televised news came up a week later.
Right, right. And we were, you know, we were just not that closely related to what was going on in the lower 48 or in the rest of the world, for that matter.
Yeah. I'm looking at the 1963 yearbook. There's a gorgeous photo of Walter Phillips in the Legislative Council, and then a list of Legislative Council members who aren't photographed, and Gail MacIver is there. Did you know each other that early?
We did. During my freshman... And we had freshman initiation those days, and it was a week.
That's right.
A whole week of initiation. And one of the things on initiation, one Friday night, we had to do snake dances between 1st and 2nd Avenue through all the bars in downtown Fairbanks. In and out. Weave in and out this chain dance, all the freshman kids. Well, Walt was part of the fire department then. He and his firemen stood off the side and were laughing at all of us. But for some reason, I caught his eye, probably because I was so loud. And because we had to yell UAA or whatever, you know, UAF. Anyway, so we met shortly after that.
So, well, how did you get involved in the fire department then at the university?
Two reasons. One, I guess it interested me. I had worked with BLM with wildfire control. But probably most importantly, it was free room and board. And it was something I was able to do and to help meet expenses. Mm-hmm. And we had a good time. It was a good camaraderie in the fire hall. And we, right after I joined, we moved to the new hall, and it was we had the best digs in town at the time.
Did you have any memorable runs?
Some, but most of the memorable ones weren't very happy.
Mm. What about that big college fire?
Yeah, well, the biggest fire we had was an apartment building down at the bottom of the hill, right? I'm trying to think. It was the guy that went on to become Alaska Airlines vice president that owned the building.
Ron Cosgrave.
Mm-hmm. And there was three or four of the units involved, and that was probably our biggest challenge at the time we were there. We spent many an hour on that one.
And what year would that have been, Will, do you remember?
Probably 63.
Yeah. Walt came to pick me up for a date once with the old, old fire truck. What was it called?
Tibby.
That was quite a vehicle to try to climb into.
Well, part of the problem
especially
was,
in a skirt.
Yeah, and we were allowed to take it out at any time to practice driving and parking and so forth, but we weren't supposed to take civilian passengers. So we arranged this for like 6:30 in the morning. We're just going to go down the bottom of the hill and buy breakfast. And so I pulled up in front of Wickersham. She come running out, climbed in, and had trouble getting the door shut, which was okay, but the whole time she was trying to shut the door, she was standing on the siren. So by the time she got settled, everybody on campus was awake, and I was in deep cock-off. I spent a few extra hours doing grunt work at the fire hall, making up for that.
But you know, those days, the campus was real small, and, you know, virtually most everybody knew everybody on campus. And that, especially for students coming from smaller communities in Alaska, that was a real blessing, because it was then you developed your new family, new friends, and you were part of that whole home feeling there.
Did you have many students from out of state that came in those days, or was it mostly
a few? Yeah,
there were some, but not, I don't think as many as there are now.
No,
percentage wise.
Right,
we weren't that, you know, UAF was not that well known, and everybody still had the idea we were just in the land of ice and snow, and
Well, I think the ones that did come were real adventurers, and most of them had their own money. There was no particular financial aid for anybody out of state.
You know, you should talk about the rifle team, too. You were on the rifle team.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, that was took a lot of my time for a couple of years, and we had a very good team at the time. There was two teams. There was a ROTC contingent that shot in military settings against Fort Ridge and other groups. I was on that team for 2 years. I traveled with the varsity for the same 2 years, but seldom shot. I was the fifth man on the team. I was in case something happened to somebody, because there were three All-Americans on the team at the time, and so I would have been. I always tell myself I'd have been first string anywhere else in the country. But for 10 All-Americans nationwide, for us to have three of them was pretty exceptional.
You know, and the university has continually, over the years, fostered very good riflemen or shooters.
Mm-hmm. We'll give credit to Everett Horton, who was the rifle coach at the time.
Yeah.
He was a sergeant in the Army, and but assigned to the university, and did a very good job of encouraging everyone, but especially those of us that weren't the top of line, to continue with it. And to
you need the rifle range after.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
After.
Yeah. Gail, were you on any other committees?
Well, I was very active in the political aspects of life. I grew up in a political family. My grandfather was in the territorial legislature. And then my dad, my uncles in Nome were always on the city council or the mayor or whatever. So grew up in politics. I was young Republican in high school, young Republican on campus. And so just staying involved with, you know, all the different political things. But I was also very active in women's athletics. And I was on the women's basketball team from my freshman year on. And that freshman year, we were still the old rules for women's basketball. Oh, yeah. You had to play half court. That was the most ridiculous thing in the world. But I did have one benefit of being in athletics, because we grew up in Nome and because we would ice skate all the time. The university decided they wanted to offer an ice skating class. And they took the rink behind Wickersham and would flood it in the wintertime for hockey and skating. So the PE teacher came talk to me, and she said she was our basketball coach, but they wanted her to teach ice skating. And she said, Gail, I'll give you a half credit if you'll teach me how to ice skate so I can teach this class. I said, well, it sounds good to me. It got me out on the ice every couple of days, you know.
Amazing.
That was fun.
And so were you politically active and trying to get the rules changed for the girls' basketball?
Oh, no, that was way beyond my political level was on campus. That was, you know, the American Basketball Associations or National Basketball.
Right.
But I was actively involved in Young Republicans almost all of my years there, and then stayed involved in politics after that.
So what were some of the issues for the Young Republicans at the time?
Oh, they weren't necessarily national issues at all. It was the Alaskan issues that were important to people at the time that we would get involved in. And Terry Miller was one of the other Young Republican leaders. And 1 year I'd be president of the club, 1 year he'd be the president of the club. So we had good times. But we were just becoming,
Do you remember?
I remember. Not only did he come.
This is former Vice President Richard Nixon.
Yeah. Not only did he come, and the Young Republicans on campus were supposed to host and help with the reception, and Starvation Gulch was the night before, and we were all out partying, and somebody threw cherry bombs in the fire pit, the huge bonfire. And when I got home, my legs were totally burned. Mm. So the fire had penetrated through my pants and everything and really burned my legs badly. And as the night wore on, my legs got worse. So here I was supposed to be one of the, you know, servers or hostesses or kids that were helping out. And I never made it. But I remember We had quite a few dignitaries come to campus all during the time I was there.
So just going back, you said you were mostly Alaskan issues. So can you remember what some of those might have been?
So that would have been after statehood. So as we were trying to develop ourselves into a state, whether it was, you know, Department of Education, or we did take on those kind of issues, statewide issues, that the campus kids could be involved in. I'd have to go back and look it up to see what all, but I remember one big fight was, that must have been later, was when the Department of Environmental Conservation was first established under Governor Hammond. That was a huge battle in the state to not do that. So it was kind of fun to be involved in those fights.
What other dignitaries came? You mentioned Ben Nixon.
Can you help me? I would have to go back and look at the books.
Yeah.
Just to remember.
Glenn Yarborough? Looks like he was there.
Yeah.
Carlos Montoya.
Yeah, there were often the university would pair up with the city of Fairbanks.
Uh-huh. And Anchorage.
to bring entertainers.
Yeah. And I think Dr. Wood had a lot to do with bringing the dignitaries to Alaska. You know, he was very active in, like, world affairs issues and World Affairs Council and things like that, that he had a much bigger perspective than what Alaska was used to at that time.
Going back to what the university looked like in terms of buildings, you were saying it was a lot smaller then. Yeah. So what buildings?
I'll tell you what, when they built Bunnell and Woods Hole, and that was really, you know, that changed things significantly. And when we first got to campus, the dining hall was in the Constitution Hall upstairs. So that was that little floor that was the bookstore and whatever, that was our main dining hall. And so everything was fairly close then. The mines building was there. Was the engineers building there?
It was being built.
It was being built when we were there, yeah.
And Hess Hall, of course, I lived in Hess Hall.
Hess was there, and Constitution Hall, and Eielson Building was there.
All of the housing was down on the main level. There was... the buildings up on the hill hadn't been built.
They hadn't been built yet. So the campus was really enclosed.
It was truly within walking. Everything was within walking distance. Right. And the Geophysical Institute was way out.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, when we would hike up to Scarlin's cabin, we were on a hike. And I was just lost in the midst of everything else. Yeah.
Did you go down into Fairbanks that often?
We would go down every once in a while. We would go down on walk down on the railroad tracks to go downtown. We didn't have a car, and I don't think that we took the bus very often. I don't know if the bus came on campus or not.
There was bus service, but it was very
sporadic.
Not so much sporadic. It's just not very often. You could go down at 8 in the morning and you'd come back at 5.
But we would go to movies downtown, and we would just walk down the hill and walk the tracks into town, and we could get there pretty quickly.
So what social activities did they have on campus then?
Pretty much everything that they do today. You know, Starvation Gulch was a big, big factor. And there was a lot of dances. There were quite a few concerts.
They were a bit calmer. There was absolutely no alcohol legally on campus.
Legally, yes.
Were either of you there during the 67 flood?
We had just left. In fact, did we? I don't know if we left together.
Yeah,
did you?
Let's see, 60s.
I went to Nome, but we packed up. We were married by then, and we were living in Harwood Hall. Incidentally, I worked for Boyd Harwood in Nome, in the drugstore there. All the time I was going to high school. So I worked in the drugstore. So we loved being in Harwood Hall.
Yeah, and that was a new
the brand new
brand
married
new building
students.
That we moved into.
Yeah.
It was right after.
And it was built for married students?
Yes.
Was it?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Anyway, we had just left for the spring, and we had taken all of our worldly possessions, and a friend of ours had a cabin down on College Road somewhere, so put everything in there. I was working for the airlines, and so, like, a couple days before the flood, I was able to get all my stuff out of there and ship it up to Nome.
That was like, our belongings left on one of the last flights
out of Fairbanks.
Out of Fairbanks.
Wow.
And it had been stored down the Grail area, so it would have been underwater.
Mm. We had this old station wagon by then.
That never showed up.
And we never saw it again.
It was actually parked down by the university power plant, and it disappeared along with several other vehicles.
Yeah, because I've heard that the water came right up to where the stairs are.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, yeah,
yeah,
it really flooded out.
Yeah,
yeah.
You stayed with the airline after college for a while with Wien's, right?
With Wien, with Alaska and Wien. And then when after I had taught for a couple of years at Nome, and Walt and I decided we did not want, as much as we loved being up there, we did not want to be confined to a place that didn't have a road to go out. We had, you know, I had already spent a lot of my life in that situation. So we moved to Anchorage, and I went to work for Western Airlines, and then worked for them for about 8 or 9 years, and then went back to Wien.
In what capacity were you working at the airlines?
I was working in the cargo department as the executive assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went back to Wien, then I worked for the executive vice president there.
Mm-hmm.
And then after our kids came along, we just sat down one night. We were doing our income tax. And I said to Walt, he was working up on the pipeline. I mean, he was working for a private engineering firm. I was working for Wien. We had very good jobs during the pipeline days. Very good job. So we didn't need to go up to the North Slope to work. But we were doing our taxes, and I said, Walt, look at this. We're paying 53% of our income in taxes. And our kids are going to the same schools, and we're driving on the same roads as those bums down on 4th Avenue that spend all their time in the bars. We've got to do something different. So he had grown up in Palmer in a small town. I'd grown up in Nome, and we decided that was the height of the kind of the crime surge in Anchorage, too, at the beginning of the pipeline days.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different time in Alaska. And we decided that we were going to take our kids and move to a place that was a smaller community. And so we'd just have a better time raising our kids. And when I was in Nome teaching, I was a cheerleader sponsor. And we had to take the kids on this trip. And the state basketball tournament was in Homer one year. And got on the bus, drove from Anchorage down to Homer, and lo and behold, for the first time in my life, I saw an ocean. It was February. I saw an ocean that wasn't frozen. In the wintertime, I thought, oh, this should be a good place to live. So in 67, we went down to Homer and looked around and found we loved Homer. Homer was going to be just right for us, and we were able to buy a business, a sporting goods store down there, and moved down in 68. And our kids went to school down there.
Right.
All there. Graduated from Homer High School.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that you had purchased a sporting goods store.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been a lot of fun.
It was lots of fun.
It was a challenge.
our store had nothing motorized or mechanized. You had to do everything for yourself. So biking and hiking and camping and skiing. Skis were a big, big factor for us. It was fun. And our kids grew up learning how that business, and that was very good for them, especially for their math grades.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you both work in the business?
I did.
Gail did primarily. I helped some mostly with the books and with some ordering and so forth, but I was still working full-time for engineering firm for. We were still trying to get that pipeline finished.
Yeah.
Well, those were pretty exciting times for a geologist in Alaska.
Oh, very definitely.
What were some of the projects you worked on?
Well, the TAPS project really absorbed our full attention for a good many years, including it got us outside of Alaska to Houston, Texas for me for 3 years, Gail for about almost 2 years before she gave up and came back. But we accepted. We'd moved to Fairbanks in early 1970, and because that's where the activity was on the pipeline, that's where the design was happening. Well, about that time, the consortium decided that they wanted to do all the design in Houston, Texas. So we were asked, it was 60 below one day, I came to work, and my boss asked me, he says, would you mind going to Houston for 3 months? And of course I said, not at all. And so we, in a matter of about 2 weeks, sold our place, sold our car, packed up everything we owned, and moved to Houston, Texas, not knowing, thinking that we would probably come back to Anchorage after we got out of Texas. Well, that 3 months got extended to 3 years, which we didn't bank on. It was okay. We had some good memories from there, but it was very interesting because of all the people working on the pipeline, very few of us had any real working knowledge of the Arctic and subarctic, and so it was an interesting time just bringing other people up to speed.
You were on one of the first CAT trains there that went up to survey the route.
Well, when we in 69-70 we were laying out the pipeline, the pipeline route, and we traveled with just bulldozers and pulled a tent or a camp along with us, and then had drill rigs testing the soils as we went.
Yeah.
So it was an exciting time. And then we spent another 5 years proving up the soil conditions and modifying the line to suit conditions.
What did you do then when you were in Fairbanks? And Gail, what?
Well, I had a brand new baby, so I stayed on tech. And I got to correct one thing. I said, I think I said we moved to Homer in 68, and that was 78 that we moved to Homer.
Ah.
Just want to make that correction. No, I just stayed. I didn't take a job up there just because we didn't know how, our whole situation was pretty fluid at that time. So.
Yeah, we kept our house in Anchorage and had leased it out for a year initially,
yeah.
And we extended it 3 or 4 times before we got back to it.
I saw, Gail, that you were the past president and board member on the Kenai Peninsula College.
Yes.
What years was that?
Let's see, I had the store from 78 to 86, or 88, somewhere there. So it would have been in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the Homer Board, Homer Council for a while, and then to the Kenai Peninsula Board.
So just a continuation of your political,
career.
And education is obviously important to you?
Oh, very definitely, yeah. It has always been.
Yeah.
I want to go back to one thing Walt said about designing the pipeline.
Uh-huh. Yes.
A few years ago when we had that massive earthquake on the Denali Fault, you should have seen Walt's face when we realized where that earthquake was, because that was one of those innovative things that they did in designing the pipeline. You know, it's raised on those pillars and it could swing back and forth and everything. And when all was said and done and the word came out about the pipeline, that the pipeline was safe, he felt pretty good about his efforts there. So.
That was a pretty important design.
Yeah.
Had it ever really been tested anywhere, Walt?
In theory, it should work. Yeah.
Wow. We think about that as being such a corporate activity, but it was individuals that made it work.
Yeah.
There were lots of individuals. I mean, I helped a little with the foundation design for it, but we're gathering the data for the foundation design. But it was a huge effort by a lot of people.
Yeah.
That made it work.
Okay. Has it been used around the world then as a model for pipeline building? Do you know?
I honestly couldn't tell you. It's been used elsewhere in the U.S., but I don't know.
Right.
I assume it probably is something people are looking at least.
Yeah. So, Gail, let's talk a little bit more about all your political activities over the years, because you're still involved in politics.
Right. Well, when I first got to Homer, I got real involved with, the Chamber of Commerce and on the College Board, the museum and such. But I'd always had this feeling of wanting to be more into the political arena. And so in 1981, I ran for the city council, got elected to the city council. That was great fun. One of the challenges I took then was that in those days we had a lot of young kids coming to work in the canneries from all over the country. And they would come up to Homer with virtually nothing but plastic tarps. And they'd camp on the beach. And in those days, and we called them spit rats. They lived on the beach. There was no sanitation. There was no cleaning facilities, nothing. They worked in the canneries for 12, 15 hours a day and slept on the beach. Well, when they left in the fall time, and I was president of the chamber at this time, there would be tons of plastic trash on Homer's Beach. And that was going to all get washed out and put it into the crab pots or into the shrimp pots or just cluttering up the ocean. So every fall, the Chamber of Commerce would go out and do a beach cleanup. And we would take tons of trash. And it was all volunteers, people in town doing this. So when I got on the city council, one of the first things I did was to introduce legislation to prohibit visqueen tents on the Homer Spit. And to put porta potties up. Well, immediately I got this nickname, Porta Potty Phillips, which everybody thought was very appropriate. But oh, the hassle about doing away with visqueen, because everybody thought, because I owned a sporting goods store and sold tents, that was the only reason I did it. But, you know, I was just tired of cleaning up other people's trash. And that was one of the best things we did while I was on the city council, because it quit that practice. Now people have to have a tent. Anybody can sleep on the tent anywhere, but they have to have at least paid for something that they're going to take with them when they leave, which was what we had planned for. And I served a few years there, and then I went a couple years on the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly. Our meetings were always in Kenai for that. And that was interesting because then my district was all of the Kenai Peninsula, and it was fun to learn about the problems in other areas of the peninsula, but to get to know all the people on the peninsula. And 1988, I ran then for the first time for the House of Representatives, and I ran against a gentleman, a state trooper named Swackhammer. So I told him in our kitchen cabinet, our private slogan was going to be, since my last name was Phillips and his was Swackhammer, would you rather be hammered or screwed? So we start all our meetings every day with that. And he loved it. He was a very good opponent, and of course I was not going to win because he was a state trooper and a Democrat, and everybody loved him.
And he was also an incumbent.
And he was an incumbent. So anyway, I lost that first race. I ran again. He didn't run again the next time. So then I won then from all the 90s. I had five terms in the House of Representatives. Two of those terms, one term I served as majority leader and two as Speaker of the House. And I loved it. It was great. That was a great time of my life.
What were some of the major issues then of the days?
Well, we had a major education reform, redoing the way education was funded. We did major tort reform legislation. We finally settled the mental health lands trust issue, which had been going on since statehood. We tackled some really big issues. The one issue that I worked for almost 10 years on that we didn't get settled, and now we're realizing the drawback in that, was the issue of subsistence. And when we as Alaskans didn't take control of subsistence, the federal government said we will take control, and that's where we stand today, with federal government control of subsistence on federal lands. And that's unfortunate because it is, it'll continually, constantly be a problem because there's two different management systems and it just doesn't work.
Did you try to tackle the issue or it just...
We had so many special sessions on it. We had so many pieces of legislation. We had a group that was so dug in opposing doing anything. We wanted to do a rural priority. If you lived in rural Alaska and you were depending on fish and game, we wanted to give that as a priority. And we just couldn't get that legislation passed. And we tried for many, many years to get that passed. But the time I was in the legislature, we really tackled some major big issues. You know, we became a state in 59, and then for the next 5 or 6 years, those legislators that were there then did an incredible job establishing a state government system. And then over the years, it got refined somewhat. By the time I got there, then there needed to be some major changes.
Right, yeah. So it was,
so it was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And being Speaker of the House, that must have
been... Oh, yeah, that was wonderful. That's where being the oldest of seven kids really came in.
Any memorable days that stand out in your mind in that role?
Oh, many of them were.
How do you think, then, that your education and your time at UAF prepared you for all of these roles?
Well, I think anything, any education a person has develops your life skills further on in your life. So, and I just always urge people to go on. Whether it's education in a vocational trade or academic trade or whatever, get more education so you know what's out there, mm-hmm. so you know what life has to offer. Because if you don't keep learning, it was just like the example I used of who would have ever believed we could see somebody talking on a telephone. Mm-hmm. No.
And you were saying earlier that you're hoping that your grandson is going to go.
Oh, yes, they will. Yeah, Walt and I take our permanent fund and have established their college funds with that. So,
right,
yeah.
And Walt, how did UF years help form foundation for what you went on to do later on in life?
Well, I guess it was just kind of a natural progression. As I was, as an undergraduate, I worked for several years for the State Division of Mines and Minerals, which is now DGGS. And in the summers, and then in the winter, I worked with the highway department in their laboratory in Fairbanks, part-time. And that led then to summer work after graduation. And when Gail insisted that we decided to move back to Nome, I was able to get a position with the DOT there. And then later transferred with them again to Anchorage, and then with the start of the interest in the TAPS project, those of us working with the highway department were best suited for that project. I mean, we had the most understanding of the foundation conditions along the corridor, and it was a little tough on the. On the state at that point, because a number of us jumped ship to the project, and but it was a natural thing to do, and it was monetary incentive was terrific,
and once in a lifetime project,
and it was an opportunity to do something that hasn't been done since.
Mm-hmm. Huh. What made you want to go back to Nome then after university, Gail?
Well, you know, because that was my family, and that's my and I got a teaching degree, but because I had worked for the airlines during my high school years, so I got a very good job as a manager for Munns Northern Airlines to go back when I was out of school. Went back there, and it wasn't going to be enough to keep me really interested. But in September of that year, so we left school in May. I worked the summer. Walt was, you were gone most of the time, I think. No, you were.
No,
you were there for the highway department. Anyway, September 1st, the high school business teacher came. They had hired him from out of state. He came to Nome. He told the taxi driver, "Get me back to the airport before that plane leaves."
Oh.
September 1st, the high school had no business teacher. And somebody knew that I had just gotten a degree in business. And they said, "Well, why don't you call her and see?" And they called me up and said, will you come and teach?" And I said, "Sure, that would be fine." So I get into the class room, and first of all, the first class is the typing class. And it's all manual typewriters, one electric typewriter. And I'm thinking, okay, I can handle this, you know. These kids have to learn how to, the keyboard anyway. But I pick up the typing book, and it has my mother's, the book I picked up had my mother's name in it. So the first day of class, I had all the kids pick up all the books, and I said, follow me, and we went to the principal's office, and I had told them to stack the books right there, and I said to him, when we move into the 20th century, I said, then we can do something here. Well, everybody was shocked. Nobody had paid attention to what was going on. And thank goodness, the old man that was running the audiovisual department had so much money in audiovisual, he didn't know where to spend it. And he said, Gail, if you want some money for new equipment and stuff, you can have my money. So that year, we got brand new typewriters. We got brand new books. Another funny thing that happened that year was I had quite a large bookkeeping class. And bookkeeping classes have maybe 20, 30, 40 pages of homework every day. I mean, it's mostly math. And so no teacher ever had time to correct those kind of pages. But that winter, Walt and two of our other friends from the university, Leo Rasmussen and his brother, and John Wood, so four young guys from the university, and then there was another guy, part of the group. Anyway, had no work. And I had the only salary. And so it was pretty slim for all of us that winter. But I realized these guys were getting together every morning to go down to the coffee shop and have coffee and plan mining adventures. So it didn't take me very long to give them all my bookkeeping paperwork to grade. And those kids, when they found out that their paperwork, they all took bookkeeping because it was going to be a snap course and they didn't have to do any, I mean, who cared? Well, when they found out their papers were going to be always graded, that was a rude awakening for them.
I'm just going to change the film, okay?
Are you watching your time?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Did your flight leave at 3?